I'm glad to see all of you here today. I was a little bit afraid that I may have scared you off yesterday. I got another affirmation just before the meeting from one of the sisters that came to me and asked a follow-up question that indicated to me that she understood exactly everything I was saying, and that just thrilled me. So I know that for some of you it was a little bit power-packed yesterday and maybe a little bit more than you could digest completely, but I wanted to make an effort to show you that there are ways that we can actually know what we're doing. And if we are going to apply the best science to agriculture, it's going to require some work on our part. You can't avoid that. But you know, I've been here, I'm starting to get a little edgy because I've been away from my garden now for over 100 hours, and I'm starting to get a little bit uncomfortable about that. But in that 100 hours or so, the last five days that I've been here, one question that I'm almost always asked in a large group, I haven't been asked yet. I've been asked a similar question, and that is, Bob, what's the best way to? And then a gardening question. But the question I'm usually asked in a group of this size is, Bob, what's the easiest way to? And nobody's asked me that question yet, and that just warms my heart. I know I'm in the right place with the right people, because you folks recognize that it's by the sweat of our face and by effort and by a commitment in our hearts to do something that things happen. And the easiest way is never the best way in agriculture, unfortunately. So I'm grateful for that too, and I appreciate all of you that have approached me and had some questions. My intention today is to talk a little bit about pest control. And you know, common questions that I get in groups are, you know, have to do with the threats that come to our gardens in the way of pests. And those pests include insects and other arthropods, and some of the pests are four-legged with antlers, and in some instances, you know, we're a little bit free from that here because we live in a rural environment, but a lot of folks too that live in urban areas have two-legged pests that like to carry watermelons and things out of their garden as well. So we have to think about how we're going to you know, secure the effort that we have. And in this regard too, we have to recognize that we are engaged in a great controversy, and that there is a war raging, and this war in our gardens, unfortunately, takes place all the time, and we want to get to that. The other day I showed you this picture though, and I think maybe I gave you some wrong information. Someone asked where this was taken, and the person that provided this picture to me told me that it was taken in Russia, but I was looking at this real close last night, and I noticed there's a flag here. And this flag, you can see right here, and that's a Swiss flag. So this may have been taken in Switzerland. I don't know. I'll have to try to confirm that. But there's one here, and then down here there's another one that looks to be a Swiss flag too, and maybe one or two others in here. So I'll have to confirm exactly where this was taken. But still, this to me is just a beautiful picture of what could be in our neighborhoods as well, if we have to live in a crowded neighborhood. I prefer the open spaces of the country. This is a graphic that I found a few weeks ago talking about the growth of home gardening in this country. And just to give you an idea, you know, we all kind of want to know how we measure up in terms of what's going on in the world when it comes to gardening. And this gives us some interesting statistics. I should have brought my glasses up here. I can't see this real clearly, and I know that you can't either, but I'll try to point some things out to you. This tells us that the average garden size in the country is about 600 square feet. So if your garden's bigger than that, that makes you a serious gardener, I guess. 600 square feet is not very large, but that's the size of the average garden in America. Today, 79% of the gardeners have a college education. That's pretty remarkable to me. I'm pretty surprised by that. And let's see, almost 70%, unfortunately, are 45 or older. That means that we need to do a better job of engaging our young people in this activity. Over half the gardeners are females. Gentlemen, time to step up here. And then it goes on to give some other statistics about what's being grown. But down here at the bottom, it gives some interesting information about the value of the produce that's produced. On average, people spend $70 on their gardens and they get a return of, I think that's $530 for their investment. So anyway, the point here is just to emphasize that gardening is becoming a more and more common activity in the United States. And there's a big movement afoot right now for people to start producing more of their own food. And, you know, we participate in a farmer's market every week. My wife yesterday was at the farmer's market, and when I spoke to her last night about how things went, she indicated something that's been happening regularly, and that is that, well, more people were there than were there the week before, and this just is kind of the case throughout the country. A lot of folks around the country have an awareness, a growing awareness of problems with our food system. They're starting to patronize local farmers markets. A lot of folks are taking it upon themselves to grow food. Those of you that are serious about gardening, how many of you mail order your seeds for your gardens? Now, have you encountered what I have encountered, and that is that oftentimes by the time you get around to ordering your seed, they're out of the variety that you want? The demand for seed is enormous. So my recommendation to you, if you think you're going to be gardening next year, is to get your seed orders in now. The typical vegetable seed harvest is in the fall, and that's when the greatest availability of seed is. That's when I order my seed. I usually order my seed in late September, early October. And even this year, I was unable to get a couple of the varieties that I wanted, even placing my order right at the prime time, so to speak, for getting what I wanted to get. This isn't going to change. I think that we're going to see, because of economic circumstances in the country this year and people's growing awareness of these issues about food, that we're going to see demand for vegetable seed increasing. And it's a good time to think about that. So my suggestion to you all is to acquire what you want to acquire now. These things can be stored for a period of time, and it's better to have them on hand when you need them rather than trying to compete with everybody else. We saw this slide the other day, and I pointed out to you that pesticide residues are really a pretty serious thing, because dominantly they affect the frontal lobe of our brain, and that is important to us, not only because of our physical health, but because this is our seat of reasoning and discernment for spiritual issues too. If we're going to be powerful witnesses, it's a very difficult challenge to be a powerful witness if you've got a compromised frontal lobe. So I want to take a little time today, because I know that most of you are aware that pesticides are a problem. In fact, I don't think, if I asked who's in favor of the use of dangerous toxic pesticides, I don't think anybody would raise their hand. But oftentimes when we're engaged in conversation with others and we raise this issue of pesticides and we try to explain to people why buying organic food is a good idea because of the lower pesticide residues, to folks that are uneducated, they usually pop up with another question, and that is, well, why? Why are they dangerous? And unfortunately, most of us don't have good answers for that question. So today I want to give you some good factual answers about why we don't want pesticides in our food. Now, the whole pesticide issue really came to light at the birth of what has come to be called the environmental movement. Back in 1962, a woman by the name of Rachel Carson wrote a watershed book called Silent Spring, in which she outlined some of the occurrences that were happening in the environment because of the proliferation of a toxic pesticide called DDT. DDT was an organochlorine pesticide that was widely used in this country, and it was very effective at controlling insects, but it was also doing some very serious damage to wildlife. And as we examine human physiology, we become aware, too, that it's had a profound impact on human health, too. In 1972, this pesticide was banned in the United States, although it is still manufactured here and sold overseas. But even though it was banned here in 1972, recent studies on soil and plant tissue from organic growers still in some instances find DDT residues in both the produce and the soil, even on organic farms, from applications that were made 40 or 50 years ago. It's very, very persistent in the environment and has been a serious problem. This awareness, this book Silent Spring and the awakening of this awareness of pesticides led the pesticide industry kind of to repackage or repicture pesticides, if you will, for the American public. And a lot of the criticism of pesticides has kind of diminished over the last few years. We think that we have stricter laws now, which we do. We have stricter standards now, which we do. But the reality is that the hazards are still very present in our food system. Not only because in some small ways these new standards have not really fully protected us from the residues that they should, but because so much of our produce today is imported. As I said, we still manufacture DDT in this country. It's shipped overseas. It's applied to food products overseas that eventually find their way back into our marketplace. And that's an unfortunate fact. But I want to go quickly through some classes of pesticides here that are used to give you a little bit of an understanding of why they're dangerous. And the first group that we have on this slide here are organochlorines. Organochlorine pesticides include things like DDT. And there are virtually hundreds of different organochlorine pesticides that are all essentially in their mode of action, either neurotoxins or disruptors of the endocrine system, the hormone system that helps to control many of our bodily functions. What makes these particular pesticides so dangerous is that they are fat soluble. That means that they come into our bodies and they take residence in fatty tissue in our bodies and they don't get washed out in the normal processes of our respiration and in our ingestion of food and water and other things. They don't get sweated out. They don't get passed through our digestive system. They simply accumulate over time in the fatty tissue in our bodies. And one of the fattiest organs in our bodies is this one right here, our brains, as well as livers and other parts of our systems, in which we have seen a dramatic increase in recent years of all kinds of health anomalies. When we look at the tremendous increase in dementia that has occurred in our society over the course of the last 20 years, this is exactly what scientists would project and expect based on a population that for a lifetime had been exposed to neurotoxic pesticides. Now, there are a lot of other potential explanations that have been postulated about the Alzheimer's epidemic, but Alzheimer's is not the only form of dementia that's on the increase. And I think all of us have recently probably experienced, either in our families or in our circle of friends or certainly within our church families, examples of people that have suffered this fate. Because they're fat-soluble, they accumulate in the body. That means that the DDT that I was exposed to as a child is probably somewhere in this frame that's standing before you today, and it's not going to decrease until the Lord comes to claim me. These organochlorine pesticides have a very, very long half-life, and a half-life is the period of time that it takes half of the pesticide compound to break down. For example, if a pesticide has a half-life of 1 year, that means after, and I apply 1 pound of pesticide, that means that after 1 year, a half pound of that pesticide is still present. In another year, a quarter pound of that pesticide is still present. In another year, an eighth pound is still present. So it can persist in the environment for a very, very long time. And that's been the case with DDT and some of the other organochlorines that have been used. Chlordane is another example of a chemical that comes from this class of chemistry. And chlordane was widely used as termite treatments around houses. I bought an old school building over in Menorah, and just for curiosity's sake, I did a soil sample at the base of the building because I know that that building was probably treated sometime in that period of 50 years, not necessarily for termites because it's a concrete building, but since they had school kids there, I'm sure that they wanted to prevent lice and other creepy crawly creatures from entering the building, and guess what? We found chlordane in the sample, and I wasn't surprised at all by that, but chlordane, again, is a pesticide that has been banned and hasn't been in the marketplace for decades, but yet it's still in the environment. The second class I want to talk about are organophosphates. Organophosphates have a similar mode of action. They're very powerful. They work very quickly. They, too, are neurotoxins and endocrine disruptors. They also are fat-soluble and can accumulate in the body. But their half-life is usually weeks rather than months or years. It has a much shorter half-life. And in that sense, when the pesticide industry tried to tell you that things were safer after DDT was pulled off the market, the organochlorine pesticides were actually replaced with organophosphates, which are frankly more toxic. But they do have a shorter half-life, and for that reason, they don't persist in the environment as long. Now, this half-life is an important thing for us to understand because when we treat food with something as highly toxic as an organophosphate poison, how then can that food become safe for us to eat? And the reality is that the rates at which these organophosphates are used on food are rates that are much higher than any pesticide standards would allow or to be considered safe for us to consume. The reason that they are allowed is because of this half-life. And when the EPA evaluates one of these pesticides for safety, there's usually on the label for the pesticide what's called a pre-harvest interval. And that pre-harvest interval is the period of time that it will take for that pesticide to break down to a point where it is acceptable in terms of the risk to human health. I say this because there's one food particularly that most of us eat that is treated with organophosphate compounds, and if we try to eat these things early or soon, we run the risk of ingesting more of this compound than we would if we allow it to ripen. And that particular food is a banana. Bananas are grown with a systemic form of an organophosphate that is pretty powerful if we're eating green bananas. So please, let your bananas ripen. If you buy food from the market that in any way is not fully ripe, ripen it first. And in this particular case, allowing your food to age a little bit is actually a good thing. You are going to lose nutrition that way, but you'll have less exposure to some of these organophosphate compounds. Let me just make a couple more points here, and then I'll take some questions on this if you have any, because I want you to understand this. We need to give an answer for what we believe, right? And if we believe that these pesticides are bad, I want you to understand some of the reasons for that. The third class that I have listed here are called carbamates or carbamates. These are also neurotoxins and endocrine system disruptors. These all work by disrupting the neural transmission within the insect. Unfortunately, it works on our neural transmission too. Carbamates differ from the other two in that they are water soluble. That means that we can over time eliminate these from our body so that they don't accumulate, and that is a good thing. Carbamates also have a much shorter half-life so that they're not as persistent in the environment and they're not as persistent in our body. They break down much more quickly. But unfortunately, carbamates are still widely used, and unfortunately, they're also widely used by home gardeners. The most prominent example I can give you of this class of pesticides is a pesticide called 7. And I know that some of you here probably still use 7 in your gardens. I mean, it must be safe, right? They sell it at the local hardware store, they sell it at Walmart, they sell it everywhere. And when I drive around this time of year and the potato bugs are out and I look across somebody's potato field and it looks like it snowed on top of it, it just makes me cringe because these things are powerful toxins, not only because it is something that you're exposed to in your food, but even in handling these things. These dusts can be absorbed by your skin. Our skin is a very powerful avenue for the absorption of pesticides. And when you use a dust form of a pesticide, your potential for inhaling it is also very high. So it's sad to me that this product is still so widely used and so easily accepted by people. We do have some alternatives, and I'm going to share those with you. But 7 is certainly not something that I would want in my garden, and I encourage all of you here today that may still be making use of this because of tradition and a lack of understanding, that you consider some of the alternatives that I'm going to present to you. Now, you had a question here. I'm going to get to that in just a moment here. Let me talk a little bit about some of the newer generation pesticides too. I'll take some questions in a couple of minutes here, but I'd like to complete this segment. There are some new generations of pesticides too that are actually based on different modes of action than simply attacking the nervous system or the endocrine system. And one of the common or one of the more popular ways for dealing with insects is to isolate specific hormones within the insect and apply those to the crop. And these hormone disruptors, if you will, are extremely powerful at very low rates. Hormones are incredibly powerful chemicals, even in very, very tiny amounts. But all living things produce and respond to hormones. Hormones in insects are what trigger the responses for their metamorphosis, for the change from that caterpillar larva into a pupa and then into an adult moth or butterfly. That's all based on a system of very delicate balances of chemistry and controlled by hormones. And what we're seeing now is a whole new generation of pesticides that is based on this technology, and the concept is that we are going to arrest the development of the insect before it reaches a point where it threatens our crops. What the long-term health impacts of our exposure to these very, very potent chemistries is, I don't know. Now, are they safer than the other chemistries? I really can't answer that question. The way that the government evaluates studies that are done on pesticides is basically to rely on the information that the companies that are producing these pesticides provide to them. So we don't have a third party that is looking at this information in any kind of a credible way to make certain that these things are safe for you and I. I can't tell you that these things are dangerous, but I can't tell you that they're safe either. Another important aspect of the pesticide industry are the inert ingredients that are listed on the label. Now, typically, we think of the word inert as meaning not having any activity, right? Well, in the world of pesticides and pesticide labeling, it has a little different connotation. The word inert simply means ingredients that aren't the active ingredient for which the pesticide is labeled. And these are compounds that are added to pesticides to help them dissolve in water, to help them spread or be miscible on the surface of the leaf, to help the plant absorb the chemistry. And these things can be very, very dangerous. In fact, many of them are known carcinogens. And some of these compounds we know to be benzene and xylene and other carcinogenic compounds. In the case of one material in particular, Roundup herbicide, there is an ingredient in Roundup called acrylamide, which is a very, very powerful neurotoxin. And yet, these things are not evaluated for their health effects because they're considered as inert ingredients, and in many cases, in pesticide formulations, they are considered as CBI, or confidential business information, and the companies don't even have to disclose what these inert ingredients are. So there, I think, as you can see, there are a whole host of reasons here why we want to avoid these things. But the bottom line is that their potential for causing damage to the human body is very, very high. And part of what makes this acceptable to industry and acceptable to government is what they call a risk-benefit analysis. They take a very toxic compound, for example, and they evaluate whether the risk that that compound poses to society is outweighed by the benefit that it provides. And that benefit is typically the food that would otherwise be damaged by the pest. So if you think that eating apples without a wormhole in it is the ultimate objective, and you think that if one in 10,000 people may be exposed to pesticide that will either kill them or cause them great bodily injury, and you accept that as being an adequate risk-benefit, then you're in agreement with how the United States government evaluates these things. Did I make that point clear? The safety standards that we have for pesticides do not mean that food is safe at those levels. They know that it's going to cause some degree of damage to the population. But the feeling is that the damage is offset by the benefit of having apples available to everyone. Now, the other thing that is very important about many of these pesticides and all of these classes is that most of them are formulated to be what we call systemic pesticides, and I think this will answer your question. A systemic pesticide is actually absorbed into the plant tissue and moves around and migrates throughout the plant, providing protection for a long period of time to the entire plant. But it is also present in the produce that is harvested from that plant. If it's an apple, folks, the pesticide is not just on the apple, it's in the apple. So these are things that we can't easily wash off. You know, there are a lot of products on the market today for cleaning your produce, and there are waxes and other compounds that may be effective for, but in terms of eliminating all the pesticide from our food, that's a ludicrous concept because the pesticide is in the food, not just on the food. A lot of our crops are treated with pesticides even after harvest. In order for lettuce to sustain a journey from the Salinas Valley to Charleston, West Virginia, it's going to be treated with a fungicide even after it's harvested. Now, it still makes sense, folks, to wash your produce. I'm not saying just be careless and don't wash your produce, but don't think that you're protecting yourself or your family if you do a thorough job of washing conventionally grown foods, because the pesticide is not going to be eliminated. Does that answer your question? All right. I want to read a statement here that some of you might be familiar with. We're a pretty educated group here at this camp meeting, but oftentimes folks have never seen this statement before, and I want to take a minute to explain this too. This is from Selected Messages, Book 3, page 329. This earth has been cursed because of sin, and in these last days, vermin of every kind will multiply. These pests must be killed, or they will annoy and torment and even kill us and destroy the work of our hands and the fruit of our land. In places, there are ants, which entirely destroy the woodwork of houses. Should not these be destroyed? Fruit trees must be sprayed, that the insects which would spoil the fruit may be killed. God has given us a part to act, and this part we must act with faithfulness. Then we can leave the rest with the Lord. This was written while she was at Avondale. And it's important to note that she's advocating the spraying of trees here. Now, most of us, because we've also got the health message, probably had a concept, at least I had a concept when I was early on in this faith that, you know, I'm sure Ellen White was an organic grower. You know, she wouldn't use toxic stuff on her food. But the reality is she's advocating the spraying of fruit trees here. And brothers and sisters, the products that they used at that period of time were extraordinarily toxic. Things like lead arsenate, arsenic, mercuric formate, different compounds of mercury, all kinds of things that have pretty serious side effects and are extremely toxic. But one significant difference between the materials of that time and the materials of today is that the greatest hazard was to the person that was spraying these things and not the person consuming the product, because these essentially resided on the surface of the foods and could be washed off. so that the food itself was not heavily contaminated if you practiced good hygiene with your food. But the workers that handled these products and the exposures that they had certainly could have led to some health effects. So we have to kind of think a little bit and realize that in many ways we're blessed today more than we were then because we have applied some science to how to go about dealing with pests, and that has led us to what we call now natural pest control. What I want to share with you now are methods that I use. I'm not saying that these are the only methods, but these are methods that I use. Someone asked me a question a little bit before the meeting, too. They looked at my list of seed companies that I gave you yesterday, and she was asking me about some other seed companies that may have very good quality seed, too. The reason that I gave you the list that I did is that those are all companies that I have personal experience with and have personally dealt with. I'm not saying that those are the only ones that are good, but those are the ones that I have personal experience with. And that's what I'm going to share with you today in terms of natural pest control are methods that I have personal experience with and the methods that I have chosen that I consider to be the most successful. Our first line of defense in the garden, and don't underestimate this, is prayer. I pray for my crops no less than 2 times a day. I pray for them in the morning when I rise, when I'm doing my devotions, before I get out of bed in the morning, I pray. I pray for my crops. I pray for their protection. When I go to bed at night, the last prayer I offer is for my crops. Not just me, but my family. We constantly are praying that our crops will be protected. That is extremely important and very, very powerful. Very, very powerful. I had friends last year at the farmer's market when I first started taking cucumbers to the market that were absolutely astonished because everybody in our county had been infested with cucumber beetles. And everybody's cucumbers were a disaster last year except ours. And people wanted to know what I was doing. And I didn't spray them with anything. I didn't take any measures against cucumber beetles last year, but we were praying. So I shared that with them. One of my best friends at the market says, "Bob, what are you doing?" And I said, "Well, I pray." "No, come on, really, what are you doing?" They thought I was keeping a secret from him. "Well, I pray." You know, I've known him for a couple of years now, and he knows now that I'm serious. And when I pray for things, we pray at the beginning of the market, my wife and I, for for good results at the market that day. And he hasn't joined in our prayers yet, but he stands real close to us and listens. So, you know, I have great hopes for my friend. Those are the ways that we witness that are very powerful. The second most important factor in protecting our crops from pests is to have healthy plants and a good sanitary environment in our gardens. The nutritional points that I was making yesterday are very helpful in preventing real serious problems in our crops. Now, I want to dispel a myth. Some people think that if we have healthy crops, we won't have pests and we won't have disease. That's a myth. Bugs like good food just as much as we do. But the difference in having a healthy plant versus a plant that is stressed is that a healthy plant can overcome the damage more easily that are done by pests. And it is true that plants that are under stress tend to be attacked first. So having healthy plants can help to minimize the damage from insects, but it's not going to make you immune. Resistance does not mean immunity. So we want to have healthy plants, and that starts with the soil. We've got to get our soil balanced properly. We want to make sure that we have adequate moisture in the soil, that we're not putting our plants in situations where they're either too saturated or too dry, and that will help a lot with controlling pests. Another very important aspect of pest control is to scout vigorously. And by scouting, what I mean is keep your eyes open for the enemy. Watch for the enemy. We want to see those troops when they first start to infiltrate our zone. As soon as they come across our borders, we want to know that they're there so that we can devise our strategy for dealing with them. And by scouting vigorously, basically what I mean here is developing powers of observation in the garden. Now, I have been doing this for so long that I cannot go into the garden and have someone standing there talking to me and do the job that I need to do. When I go into the garden, my first desire is to have just a few minutes alone in the garden. And as I have those few minutes alone, I am looking for all kinds of little minute details in that garden every time I walk through it. And oftentimes the Holy Spirit will lead me to problems in the garden. And I believe that's a result of the prayer that I offered earlier that day to help me protect my plants. And all of a sudden I'll feel a little tug and the Lord will direct me, His angels, will direct me to a particular problem that might be in that garden that would have gone unnoticed otherwise. Now, you can't be a good scout if you're only in your garden once a week. You can't be a good scout if you're not being attentive to what's happening with those plants. One of the greatest skills that is developed among gardeners or agriculturalists that are good at what they do are the skills of observation. It's critically important, and this is particularly good for kids. It helps to instruct kids about how to pay attention to many different things. I often walk through the garden with my daughter later in the morning, and without telling her what I've seen, I'll ask what she's looking for, or ask her what she sees. And we've kind of made I won't say a game out of this, but an exercise out of this. And she knows if I'm pulling her out there that there's something to find, and it's kind of a hide-and-seek, a treasure hunt, if you will. And by that, I'm trying to help encourage her powers of observation, too. But that's an important thing to do, is to scout regularly. We look for evidence when we're in the garden of what's causing damage. Oftentimes, we'll find damage in our gardens, but we won't find the bad guy. We won't find what's causing the damage. And by understanding a little bit about insects and their mouth parts, it can help us diagnose who the enemy might really be. And with insects and other problems that we have in the garden, there are basically three different mouth types or mouth parts that are used for causing damage. We have sucking insects, chewing insects, and rasping insects. Now, a chewing insect usually leaves a hole or leaves, part of the leaf missing. It's pretty easy to find. A sucking insect is something like an aphid or a spider mite that has a small proboscis, a little bit like a mosquito does, and it sticks that into the leaf tissue and then draws sap out of the leaf tissue, and it leaves a little tiny stippling or a little tiny dark spot, usually in a speckled pattern on the leaf, not necessarily a hole, but there's evidence of insect damage. A rasping insect has a mouth part that basically tears at the tissue, usually on the lower side of the leaf. And leaf hoppers are an example of a rasping insect, where you'll have on the lower side of the leaf an injury to the leaf surface that looks a little bit like a scar, or it may ooze some liquid. By understanding these mouth parts of the enemy, we can help to understand what might be causing the problems in our gardens. Now, when we find bugs in our gardens, that's not necessarily a bad thing. You know, the Lord is amazingly gracious, and the powers of sin in this world, where sin doth abound, grace doth much more abound, eh? And this is very true in the gardens, too, because there are well over 100,000 different species of insects in North America, and only a relative handful, only a few thousand, cause us problems in our gardens. So just because you see a bug in your garden, unless you have identified it and recognize it as an enemy, that's why I say know your enemy here. That's the first and foremost piece of information that we need to have if we're going to conduct successful warfare. We want to gain intelligence on that enemy. We want to know everything about it that we can. We want to understand what its habits are. We want to understand what its life cycle is. Let me give you an example as to why this is important. How many of you have had problems with aphids in your gardens?
What?
Aphids.
Aphids?
Aphids.
You don't have them now,
but many of us have experienced problems with aphids. And you know, when I walk into groups and I ask, a simple question, or someone wants to offer me an anecdotal about how they've controlled aphids, I've heard all kinds of different methods for controlling aphids, including things like milk,
milk of magnesia, baking soda, hairspray, fingernail polish, all kinds of things that work to control aphids. And I said, well, how do you know it worked? Well, I sprayed them, and I went out a couple days later, and they were all gone. And I said, well, that's not surprising, because an aphid only has a life cycle of about 3 days, and even if you do nothing, they're going to disappear in 3 days. Now, that's not true if, just a moment, brother, that's not true if you have multiple generations going on, but the first time you notice them on your plants, even if you don't do anything, they're going to metamorphose into an adult, which is a fly, and fly away. So literally anything that you spray on an aphid is going to work, right? The problem's going to disappear. If you don't understand the life cycle, you don't recognize that. And unfortunately, a lot of people I know have done a lot of damage to their plants with hairspray and nail polish and baking soda and other things. Anything that we use on our plants, this is another very important point. Anything that we use on our plants, whether it's one of these natural methods that I'm going to describe for you, or something that comes in a spray bottle from the nursery or from Walmart, has side effects. Anything we use on our plants has side effects. So just because something is natural or just because something is on your shelf at home does not mean it's safe, either for you or for the plants. And I want to clarify that and make that very clear. Okay? The other thing that we want to know about insects, if we're going to know our enemy, is we have to recognize our avenues of potential attack. How are we going to deal with these critters? And one thing that we know about insects is they have a nervous system. This is what the entire chemistry of most of the last century has involved, is dealing with the nervous system of insects. We know they have a nervous system. There's an avenue of attack. They have a digestive system. They eat food and they excrete. They've got a digestive system and a stomach. There's an avenue of attack. They respire. They have a respiration system. There's an avenue of attack. And they have what's called an exoskeleton that holds their bodies in the right form. Their skeletons are actually made from a material called chitin that's on the outside of their bodies. But if you can collapse that chitin or damage that exoskeleton, they can collapse upon themselves and essentially not be a problem anymore. Anybody here know how insects breathe? Most of us have seen houseflies flying around the house, and when they land on the window, are they panting, going, we don't see that, do we? They actually breathe through holes in this exoskeleton, and gas simply passes through them. They don't have a respiratory system like you and I do, but it is possible to disrupt that respiratory system with a few of the different methods that I'm going to describe to you here shortly. Okay. Helping to manipulate our environment or manipulate our gardens to the disadvantage of the pest is an important facet in our planting. We want to be sensitive in our plant selection, to look for plants that might have some degree of natural resistance to particular pests. We want to practice crop rotation so that we don't continually build populations of insects by having the same host for that insect in the same place time and time again. This is particularly important for things like tomatoes and potatoes. Most of us right now are dealing with potato beetles, and if you're planting your potatoes in the same place over and over again, that problem is going to amplify every year that goes by. Crop timing is important, and then this again points back to understanding a little bit about your enemy. I'll give you an example of eggplant. Eggplant is very susceptible to flea beetles. And if you plant your eggplant early in the season when that first hatch of flea beetles takes place, those beetles are very voracious, and they can literally eat up a transplant overnight. If you wait about 3 weeks, though, after that first generation of flea beetles completes its life cycle, the numbers drop off dramatically, and you can plant that same plant in the same spot and have no problems with flea beetles simply based on understanding what the life cycle of that flea beetle is and avoiding that by exercising discretion in the timing of when you plant your crops. Trap cropping is another method that I use, and this involves putting something out there that is more attractive to the pest than the crop that I really want to grow. And an example of how I use this is when I grow broccoli. Broccoli is sensitive to the cabbage looper, the small little green translucent worm that likes to eat up the leaves and then eventually inhabit the heads of my broccoli. But cabbage loopers get their name because they really like cabbage. And if in my rows of broccoli I put a sporadic cabbage plant, those adult moths will be attracted to the cabbage plant rather than my broccoli plants. And in this case, I grow the cabbage plant sacrificially. I'm just going to leave it there and let the cabbage looper devour it. But it is a way of keeping the cabbage looper off my broccoli without having to use any pesticides or any spraying at all. This can be a method that can be applied to a lot of different crops because many crops have different pests have different preferences for many of these crops. Bean beetles are another problem, for example, and if you grow some varieties of beans, you'll find that they're more highly susceptible to bean beetles than others. So if you intersperse a few of these more susceptible varieties in the beans that you regularly grow, then you can oftentimes confine the pest problem to that crop and just use it as a trap, use it as a sacrificial crop. There's a small bean called a yellow eye bean that I use that I plant in among my Blue Lake string beans, for example, that is much more susceptible to the bean beetle than my Blue Lakes. And if I put just a few of those plants in my planting of Blue Lakes, that's where the pest is going to go rather than on the crop that I want. We have to recognize what weapons we have. And in our gardens, we have only really two primary weapons, and that's some of the spray materials I'm going to describe to you. But we also have predators in our garden. Here in West Virginia, we have the advantage that most of us garden in relatively isolated areas. By that, what I mean is we're not surrounded by large agricultural enterprises that are out there spraying all the time and killing off basically everything, good guys and bad guys. So we fortunately have quite a few predators of some of our insect pests in close proximity to our gardens. It's important to keep this in mind. Not that the predators are always going to control the problem for you entirely, but one thing that we want to consider in any pesticide program that we develop is that we want to maintain the greatest population of predators as possible. And that means using some discretion in how we use some of those spray materials that we do have available to us to control the bad guys. And I'll describe this in just a moment. Another method that we can make use of are repellents. There are some compounds that I use in my garden as repellents for insects. They don't kill the insects, but they will repel them. And I'll give you a formula and a specific example of that in just a minute. Now, in my arsenal for pest control in my gardens, this is what I use. I use insecticidal soaps. Notice that says insecticidal soap. That does not say Joy dishwashing detergent. It doesn't say, Dial bar soap. That's insecticidal soap. Soaps work. Joy dishwashing detergent works. And Dial bar soap works for this same purpose. But there's a very significant difference between what we consider regular soaps and these formulations that are made for caring for our plants, and that has to do with the plant safety. These insecticidal soaps are formulated in such a way that they don't do too much damage to the leaf. Now, I told you that all treatments have side effects. Insecticidal soap has a side effect too, and more harsher soaps actually strip the waxy cuticle off the surface of the leaf. And even though they'll kill the insects, they make the leaves wide open for infection from bacterial or fungal diseases. So we want to use an insecticidal soap. And the two that are on the market that are widely available in this part of the country are Safer Insecticidal Soap and a product called MPED, M-P-E-D-E. These have two modes of action. Number one, they can plug those spiracles that the insect breathes with and suffocate them. Number two, on soft bodies in insects, it can actually crush the exoskeleton and allow that insect to just basically collapse on itself and crumple. Now, insecticidal soap is a very powerful tool. It works very well. I keep a bottle of this in my greenhouse, and when wasps fly into my greenhouse, I can literally knock them out of the air with soap. I can spray them with this soap and they will immediately drop because it has such a powerful effect. Non-toxic. This is non-toxic stuff. But one of the problems with using insecticidal soap is you have to hit your target. You have to hit the enemy. And if you spray your plants with it and the material dries on the leaf of your plant, it's going to have no effect at all. So you actually have to hit the bad guy. This is another important reason for scouting and taking care of populations of insects before they develop into a serious problem. It's also non-selective. It'll kill whatever it hits. And that isn't always an advantage to the predator populations that we may have in our gardens. The next two products here, BT, which is short for Bacillus thuringiensis, a brand name for this particular product is Dipel, and Spinosad, the second one, are both forms of bacteria that produce poisons for insects. These are not poisonous to us, only insects. And because they are stomach poisons, the insect actually has to eat some of this in order to be affected by it. That makes these two types of materials far more selective. Only the bad guys get killed when you use this stuff. And in that sense, it's a better way to go about dealing with our pest control than with either insecticidal soaps or the last one I'm going to mention here, pyrethrum. Only the bad guys are damaged by these two things. And because the insects have to eat them, these will last on the surface of the leaf for a period of time. I can spray either BT or Spinosad and usually get protection until we get a real heavy rain shower or sunlight will break these down over time after a few days. But it'll work. It'll stay on the leaf surface and work for a few days at least. It's not like spraying my crops with an organophosphate compound that's ingested into the crop and can stay active for 30 or 40 days, but it still is a very effective way of keeping some of these insect species from causing us problems. The last one I'm going to mention is pyrethrum. Pyrethrum is derived from a particular strain of chrysanthemum, and it has a neurotoxic effect, but only on insects. There are some studies that are being done on some of the things that they add to pyrethrum that caused me a little bit of concern about their overall safety. But pyrethrum itself, particularly if you get it from a source that caters to organic gardening, is certified for organic use, as are all these other materials too, I might add. But pyrethrum is non-selective. It's very powerful stuff. It works in very, very small quantities. 1 ounce of pyrethrum is enough to make over 100 gallons of spray. And it kills virtually any insect, non-selectively. And this, again, can cause problems with our predator populations and taking out the balance in the ecology of our gardens. So that if you use pyrethrum, oftentimes the pest will reappear, but all the predators are gone, and you'll have even a more serious pest problem than you initially dealt with, which means that you have to spray pyrethrum again, and before you know it, you're on that pesticide treadmill where you're having to spray pyrethrum over and over again to have good control. That's the whole list for the chemical arsenal for things that I use. And this is a much smaller list than what conventional growers have available to them. In fact, there are probably over 500 different insecticides alone that are used commercially in agriculture today in the United States, but these four materials are the only ones that are really widely used in organic agriculture. I want to make the point here too to say that just because something is natural does not mean it's safe. These four compounds have been certified for organic use: sabadilla, rotenone, nicotine, and neem. And all four of these have some pretty significant health effects on us. One specifically that I want to mention here that's still very common and you can buy down at your local farm supply is rotenone. Rotenone has been linked very positively to Parkinson's disease. So these, although they are natural and they are certified as organic, I consider to be unsafe, and I wouldn't advise you to use them. The repellent that I was telling you about is can be effective on plants, and this is a fairly simple material to make. I use it most commonly for the squash bugs that you see in the upper left of this picture. Many of us have problems with squash bugs. And this material doesn't kill squash bugs. Well, it will if you hit them with it, but I use it more for a repellent. What I use is 2.5 ounces of insecticidal soap, 2 tablespoons of sulfur, and 1 gallon of water. And then I spray the stem and around the base of the plant with this solution. I don't spray the foliage with it, especially on young plants, because the sulfur can burn the leaves and cause damage to the plant. And it discourages the squash bugs from inhabiting our plants. They'll move on to your neighbor's plants, which don't have this distasteful sulfur on them, and it can work as a repellent. It works fairly well for cucumber beetles, too, before they're well established on your plants. And basically, I'll just spray the bottom inch or two of the stem of my plants and around the base of the plant out to a few inches. And I'll do that perhaps once a week or once every 10 days during the period of time that I notice that the squash bugs are present and active. All right. A natural herbicide that I use, I'm going to talk a little bit about weed control tomorrow and some other things, but while I'm giving you formulas, this is a good place to include this. A natural herbicide that I use for killing weeds is actually vinegar. 5% acetic acid vinegar, check the label, some vinegar is only 3% acetic acid, but if you use it full strength with the addition of a surfactant, and a surfactant is basically something that you can get at your local farm supply that is a solubility agent for many different pesticides. There are a lot of different brand names for surfactants, but if you go to Southern States and tell them that you want a surfactant, they'll know what you're talking about. Use that at the labeled rate for the surfactant for herbicides. Usually it's on the order of maybe 2 or 3 ounces per gallon. But this vinegar in combination with the surfactant does a very good job of killing off weeds. And particularly if you do this on a hot day when it's dry, within just a few hours' time, the top portion of that weed is burnt back. This works particularly well on very young weeds and in areas where you can't cultivate efficiently, or if things start to get away from you and you do need to make use of an herbicide, this can work fairly well, and it is safe. Now, it's the acetic acid that does the work of damaging the plant tissue, and we were just talking yesterday about getting our soil pH balance just right, but the reality is that you're using such a small amount of this that it's not going to affect your soil pH. If you want to prevent weed growth for a long period of time, I have electric fences that I use to keep deer out of my garden, for example, and if I allow the weeds to grow up on that electric fence, eventually it shorts it out, so I'm either going to have to be out there with the weed eater all the time, or I can spray a strip under that electric fence and incorporate borax into this mixture at 1/4 cup per gallon, and the borax contains boron. And what did I tell you about boron yesterday? It's a plant nutrient. It's a plant nutrient. We need it at about 2 parts per million in our soil for optimum growth. But what happens when we get up to 4 parts per million? It becomes toxic to plants. Right. So essentially what I'm doing is I'm applying a toxic level of boron to a narrow strip of ground. And that will prevent things from growing there for quite a long period of time, usually a period of months. Under my electric fences, I spray 2, sometimes 3 times a year, and I have complete weed control during that whole time. Now, only do this in an area that you do not plan to plant into, right? Because we're putting this stuff down at a toxic rate. Now, the borax and the boron that's in the borax is water-soluble, and over time, it's going to leach out, and it's going to dissipate, and it's going to go away. So it's not like you're sterilizing the ground permanently with this, but recognize that you don't want to use this in areas where it could be damaging to the crops that you do want to grow. Okay, am I clear on that point? Now, when we spray, the last point that I want to make here, and then I'll take a few questions. When we spray, the most common practice among most of us is that if a little's good, a lot's better. You know, I've got bad squash bugs, so if I'm going to spray them, I want to drown them with the spray. And that's really not necessary and can actually cause us some problems with our plants too, because even something as benign as the insecticidal soap that we use, that's intended to kill bugs. And it is somewhat safe for the leaves, but when that gets down into the root zone, it can start causing problems with our microbiology in the soil, and it can also do some literal physical damage to the root system too. So we don't want to overspray things. And when I teach people how to spray, I use the analogy of spray painting. When we spray paint something, we want a nice, even coat, just thick enough to cover what we're putting it on, but we don't want runs or drips, right? And that's the way that we want to apply sprays too, whether it's an herbicide, an insecticide, a fungicide, whatever it might be. The term I use is spray to glisten. We just want that surface to glisten with the amount of spray that we have on there. Okay, these are just some slides of some of the common problems that we have. The aphids on the right, the cabbage looper on the left. You probably have some enemies of your own out there. Are there any questions? We've got about 5 minutes here where I can take some questions. And you have any... Oh, we've got a microphone here. No questions. Here we have one. All right.
What about use of diatomaceous earth?
Diatomaceous earth basically has a mode of action where you spread it on the soil and insects that crawl across it or worms that crawl across it, it's like they're crawling over razor wire. It tears their bodies apart or it shreds the chitin. And it works pretty effectively until it gets wet. Once it gets wet, its effectiveness drops dramatically. So I don't make use of diatomaceous earth because I've not had good success with it in a moist, damp climate like we have, where we have heavy dew or frequent rainfall. In more arid parts of the country, such as where I'm from in Northern California or the Southwest, diatomaceous earth can be used pretty effectively. But in this part of the country, it doesn't seem to be worth the expense to me. Yes.
Where do you get the insecticidal soap?
Insecticidal soap can be purchased from most farm supply stores, and any of the products that you saw listed here that you can't find locally, I have online sources for on my website. Yes.
When you were talking about the chemicals earlier, where does 2,4-D fall in?
2,4-D is an herbicide. It's a slightly different class. It's based somewhat on carbamate chemistry, but it does have a different form of toxicity. The primary toxicity from 2,4-D, it actually comes in two ways. One is dioxin, which is a very potent toxin that is not part of the 2,4-D, but it's a byproduct of the production of the 2,4-D that's in there. But 2,4-D is actually a very powerful plant hormone, and it has hormonal effects that stimulate aberrant growth within the plant. It doesn't really fit the organochlorine or organophosphate pattern that I showed you there. Okay. Yes. Stink bugs.
I haven't had any problem with it in our garden, but some people have, and I just want to know what's
the deal with them?
Yeah.
Well, I don't have problems with stink bugs either, other than the fact that they're unpleasant. I haven't had problems with them in the garden. The pictures that you're seeing up here are common garden pests that I have. But in that case, too, if you wanted to use a repellent, that sulfur and insecticidal soap mix would work fair as a repellent. And either of the contact forms of pesticide would use, either the pyrethrum or the insecticidal soap, would work as a means of control.
Would that work on squash bugs, too?
Yes. Yes. Back here. I'm sorry? Ants on fruit trees are an indication that you have a problem with aphids. What the ants are after is the honeydew. These are the aphids on the right here. The aphids, as they're a sucking insect that feeds on the leaf, and they excrete what's called a honeydew. And the ants use that honeydew and actually cultivate it in their nests to provide a fungal food for themselves. So where you see ants, the ants are not a problem. They're not damaging your tree. They're guarding these aphids. So if you treat the aphids, the ants will go away. Yes?
This isn't a typical year, but a couple years ago, nearly every ear of corn had a cornworm in it.
Yes.
What's the best control for that?
If you're growing corn on a large scale, the BT is effective. If you place a small amount of BT at the top of the ear, I know that mineral oil has been used traditionally on the ears too, but you've got to be careful about the timing of that because you can interfere with the pollination of the kernels of the corn if you put it on too early, and you can be ineffective with it if you put it on too late. But either method will help suppress the corn earworm. Timing also can be important. If you're in an area where year after year you have problems with corn earworm, if you get your corn in earlier in the season before the earworm really takes off and proliferates, you can often harvest undamaged corn early in the season. Usually the later you plant, the more problem with corn earworm you will have. I sustain damage from corn earworm too, but usually it's not that significant, and when I harvest my corn, I just chop the tips off. Yes?
How do we know that the microbes that you spray, the poisonous ones, how do we know that they're only poisonous to insects and not poisonous to humans?
It's been scientifically established that they're not toxic to human beings. And it's not actually the microbe itself that is toxic, it's a protein that the microbe produces. All various different life forms have different ways of digesting things, and the particular protein that is toxic to a caterpillar is not toxic to us. All right, I think I'll take two more questions and I'm going to have to cut it off here so that we can prepare for Dr. Clark's presentation.
Yes. Okay, I'm new to the West Virginia area, so coming into here, you're saying the timing makes a difference.
Mm-hmm.
I went to the extension office and got like a thing of telling you when to plan everything.
Yes.
What is the best thing to look at? I also went online and got one from this guy, and it tells you when to plant, but I think some of my things were a little bit too early.
Yes.
And they started to die off.
I pay absolutely no attention to those planting guidelines for West Virginia for two reasons. One is that we have so many different microclimates here in West Virginia that what works for you may not work for me even if I'm only a half a mile away. Because if I'm in the bottom of a hollow on the north side of a hill, I'm going to have very different soil temperatures than my friend who's gardening on the top of the hill on a southern exposure that's literally my next door neighbor. In terms of the insect issue, it really does take experimental knowledge to find that out. That's something that you're only going to learn with experience and time. And even though this is only my second year of growing here in West Virginia, every circumstance that I encounter in the garden, I make note of. I make note of the timing of when things are happening. And that's difficult when we have changing weather patterns. This year has been a very different growing season than last year. But over time, I'm going to develop enough information that will be very helpful to me in the long-term security of my garden. It's going to take me a while to acquire that. My point in raising this with you is so that you know what to pay attention to this year while you're growing. Make note of when you see the first flight of the cabbage loopers. Make note of when the flea beetles are very active. Make note of what is happening in your garden. And for this reason, I strongly recommend to people that are either new to an area or new to gardening to keep a journal. And note what the weather is doing. Note what the soil temperatures are. Note what's going on as far as pest problems, when your weeds are emerging, when things become an issue, so that you can begin to develop a data bank of information that you can draw on in the future. That's experimental knowledge. There's no substitute for that. There is no substitute for that. All right, I thank you all very much for your attention today. Tomorrow I'm going to cover some things that some of you have asked me about. And we're going to take about half of the session tomorrow to address your specific needs and your specific questions, so please come prepared for that too. Let's pray, shall we? Heavenly Father, we thank you for the refreshing rain this afternoon, and we're grateful too for the freedom to come here and to discuss these things. We thank you for all that you're doing this week, both here in the camp and in our hearts with the wonderful messages that have come to us. We ask, Father, that you would help us to bring everything that we've heard here to mind as we need it,
And may your Holy Spirit guide us and attend us for the duration of these meetings. We ask in Jesus' name. Amen.